Some things are just better together. Movies and popcorn, gaming and friends, Breezeline internet and mobile. Bundle and save with fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month, and you'll get a free mobile line for a year. It's a match made in savings. Visit Breezeline.com today.
Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolocumab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, we look at the best cameos in cinema and TV. We review The Accountant 2 and the new Tom Hardy movie, Havoc. Plus, director Aisling Lynch on writing and directing her new Irish folk horror, Frey Wacka. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. I suppose the big news from a film point of view, and I've been talking about it to a few people this week, is the new Oscar rules, and in particular one that stipulates people voting on the best movies in various categories have to have seen the movies. And this begs the question, was that not always the case? Well, apparently not. There seemed to be a vague intent that if you were nominating movies and voting on them, you should have seen them. But that wasn't specified. So now in a new ruling released on Monday, members of the Academy voting will have to ensure to have seen all the movies they're voting on, which kind of stands to reason, as I say, beggars belief. How are they going to do that? Well, a system wherein they won't be allowed to vote unless they have been seen to have accessed this particular movie or that particular movie in the screening room. It's a little thing I'm familiar with from various TV shows I've watched over the years where you're sent a code and you click on and people can see you've watched it. So that's what they're going to do. There is this, and then it will allow you to vote. So they're trying to make it foolproof. There is also this new thing that you can have seen it in a festival or something like that, but you have to kind of give a sworn affidavit of sorts that you've seen it elsewhere. So it's high time, though, I would have thought, and I think we're all in agreement that people nominating on movies for best movie and best director should have actually seen those movies. I think that stands to reason. I said this earlier in the week, it's a miracle any movie gets made. So at least the people voting for the best movie or the best director could go to the trouble of watching those movies. Also, interestingly, it said that AI would neither harm nor hinder your eligibility for winning an Oscar, which is interesting. I'll just leave that there, but you have to own up to having used it, but it will not harm or hinder your entry. So there you go. It's a brave new world. I've said that a few times this week. I don't know what it is. Certain phrases, they take a hold. Here's a phrase I say every week. This week in TV, I was watching this.
You plant the trees grow tall, then sooner or later, they begin to get mangled. And before you know it, the apples start to rot. And that, Harry, my son, is pruning time.
Right, change your plan.
Now that is a clip from Mobland, which is on Paramount Plus. We don't talk about Paramount Plus that often. We probably should more. They show things. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. A bit like Mobland, I'm afraid to say. Now, I don't want to be cruel. Tom Hardy plays basically a gangster henchman, a guy who's a fixer for a family. The family is fronted by Pierce Brosnan and Helen Mirren. It's a husband and wife, mob heads, basically. And they come into contact with another family, an equally vicious gang of London gangsters. And there's basically an incident where Pierce Brosnan's grandson seems to be in a fracas and a murder, possibly, of another gangster's son. And Tom Hardy is attempting to save the day and make everything right. He also has a wife, played by Joanne Froggatt, who really wants to leave him because he's not a very good husband, because he's dedicated to Pierce Brosnan's family as opposed to his own. Now, here's the thing. It's Guy Ritchie, and it's not a bad kind of cops and robbers gangster thing. But for me, it's ruined by Pierce Brosnan and Helen Mirren. And that's a terrible thing to say, because they are brilliant actors and actresses. They really are. But their Irish accents are atrocious. Now, you may have heard about Pierce Brosnan's one, but it's really bad. And yes, he is from Navan. Now, I know he's been away a long time, but you would have thought he could do a better stab at it, because Darby O'Gill is in the building. So for me, and my good lady wife was watching it with me and agreed that it's hard to get past it and actually see what else is going on, because every time Pierce Brosnan comes on the screen, you're like, oh no, here it comes again. That's how bad his Irish accent is. And I get no joy in kicking one of our great actors, but his accent and Helen Mirren's is atrocious. And it's like they've been told, you know, this is how you do an Irish accent by someone from English Central Casting. It's really, really bad. So it's ruining Mobland for me. I'm sorry to say. Do let me know if you might have been watching Mobland or anything on the big or small screen. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. And now we turn to the week's new cinema releases. This week we're going to be looking at, I suppose, a strange or a somewhat surprising sequel, I would have thought, in the form of The Accountant 2, where Ben Affleck is back, and a new Tom Hardy action-packed movie on Netflix called Havoc. Delighted to be joined now by regular reviewer, film critic and art journalist Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, how are you?
Very well. So listen, I mentioned it's surprising that The Accountant is getting a second iteration. And I say that because I remember at the time it got pretty poor reviews, but yet it did pretty well at the box office. But at the same time, you kind of would have thought it was a movie that was over. But you tell me.
Definitely. I mean, in 2015 or at the start of 2016, before this film was released, you had, you know, coming to cinemas, two Ben Affleck films, Batman versus Superman and The Accountant. And if you said that The Accountant was the one that was going to have more legs, and that, you know, 9 or 10 years from now, we'd be watching a second film with the director teeing up a third and Ben Affleck also producing this thing, I'd be like, stop that. You know, this guy is clearly, you know, the Batman films might work out. We were all very wrong about that. And you mentioned the box office there, like and the reviews. The Accountant wasn't panned, but the reviews were lukewarm, shall we say. And the box office, I think it was something around 150 million for a film that cost about 40 million to make, which isn't great, but it was something strange happened when The Accountant moved to streaming and, you know, moved to Blu-ray and DVD. The sales there and the streaming numbers were so big that I think the studio and the filmmakers looked at it and said, there's demand here for something, whether it's another film in cinemas, whether it's something on streamers, whether there's a TV series. That idea still hasn't gone away. So eventually, 9 years later, we get The Accountant 2.
And just to remind people, in The Accountant, Ben Affleck plays an accountant who is neurodiverse or artistic, whatever your preferred moniker is for it. And he gets involved in, he kind of becomes an action hero of sorts.
He does. It's a bit of a superhero film. It really is. And, you know, it does exactly what it says in the title. We are dealing with an accountant who is just as good with weapons and martial arts as he is with numbers. So he works, I remember in the original film, it was something like ZZZ Accountancy, which is just, you know, a red flag straight away. But he really does help people out. He does work, you know, during the day as a regular accountant, but he also has some very shady clients that he helps, you know, launder money for. And long story short, it was all very complicated and convoluted, John, a little bit like this one. This is an incredibly busy sequel. But we had a case where this, you know, determined Treasury director who actually wants to be a private investigator, he's played by J.K. Simmons, he starts to look into the accountant. And he has a protege also looking into the accountant. But then they have a shared enemy, so they have to work together and just chaos ensues, and there's all sorts of gunfights. There's a hitman brother thrown in, played by John Bernthal. We learn a little bit about the accountant's backstory and why he is the way he is and how he's able to do the things that he can do, especially with his fists and with weapons. This sequel, it says to audiences, look, we gave you the backstory. You know that this guy is, as you say, he's an autistic accountant who also happens to have a very special set of skills. He lives in a caravan by himself. We're not going to give you any more backstory, but we're going to bring back the brother, John Bernthal, who's the hitman, because there was a good response to the chemistry between Affleck and Bernthal. And I think that is the unique selling point of the film, because the plot, John, it made my head spin. I'll do my best to describe it, okay? And we're not going to give away any spoilers here because this all happens in the first 2 minutes. But unfortunately, J.K. Simmons' character, Raymond King, he dies in the opening minutes. And he's killed by, we don't know really who killed him, but his protege that I mentioned from the first film, Cynthia Day Robinson's Mary Beth Medina, she's a new Treasury director. And she is now working, you know, in cahoots with the accountant. And she goes to him and says, listen, we need to find out who killed Raymond, but also Raymond, who'd retired from his Treasury director position, had actually become a private investigator. And this case that he was investigating seems to have angered a lot of people. So not only do we need to solve a murder here, we need to solve a missing person case, and you might need to call up your brother again. So John Bernthal, the hitman from across the country, comes on board, and the three of them try to solve this impossible puzzle, which also includes some sort of shady fisherman gangster, underground, these teenage tech wizards who work underground at a school for people who are neurodivergent. And also there's a ruthless assassin running around the place. Are you confused?
Yes, very. Tell me this. Is it more successful than the lukewarm first one?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, look, this thing,
because
it made me dizzy, but I was never bored. You know, so it's jumbled and it's quite, you know, there's too many ideas in there and there's far too much plot. I read a story that apparently when this film was being developed, and these things happen when sequels take so long to come together, you've too many scripts around the place. And at one stage, I think even a screenplay for a film that wasn't supposed to be an accountant film got thrown in. So ideas from a completely different story were thrown in, which explains a lot. But at the same time, it is quite entertaining in places, and it leans more, like the first film kind of took itself a little bit too seriously at times, but it also had Anna Kendrick to provide a little bit of, she was quite good in it, and there was a bit of comic relief there. This time, they're kind of leaning more into the comedy. Now, it's tonally awkward when you've got people losing their heads 1 minute, and then you've got Ben Affleck and John Bernthal cracking jokes the next. But I liked the Affleck and Bernthal partnership. Together, they just light it up together. They spark off of one another. Bernthal, who continues to just have the biggest presence and also the best face in cinema.
He's a terrific actor. He really
is. Just, yeah. I mean, the things that guy, that he pulls the rope from under everyone around him. And he is very good with Affleck. All that stuff I did like. Couldn't follow the mystery at all. Could not make sense of it. But as I said, I was entertained. So it is quite messy, but it is watchable. It's passable. And I think, look, the people behind it, Gavin O'Connor and Bill DePook, they have stumbled upon this hit franchise. And there is something there that I think they should follow. But if they are going to follow it, if they are going to do that TV series or third film, simplify things.
Yeah. And tell me this, I mentioned that he's autistic, and I remember vaguely at the time of the first one, there was some criticism that it's somewhat of a stereotype. He's autistic, and yet he has this special set of skills nearly as a result of it. Is, here we are, you know, nearly 10 years later. Yeah. Is that handled more sensitively, or?
It's well-intentioned, let's put it that way. Right. But at the same time, it is somewhat of a problematic depiction, especially when you have the kids at the school for teenagers with who are neurodivergent. It's kind of treating them as superheroes. And some audiences might think, that's great, that's progressive, that's a step forward. But at the same time, it's sort of just like, it's all a bit one note.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, these kids are autistic, so therefore they're able to help this hitman break all of these.
Because they're all genius.
Yeah, that's it is a bit too, you know, like I said, everything else is complicated. That's a bit too simplistic, a depiction of people who are living with autism. So yeah, I'm not too sure how well it's moved forward, but I really don't think that anyone involved in this thing has a bad bone in their bodies. I think it was done with good intentions.
Yeah, fair enough. So what would you say stars-wise for The Accountant 2, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 25th of April?
Yeah, look, it's busy, it's convoluted, and it's probably a shade too long. But I had fun with it. I had fun with Affleck and Berenthal. So I'm going to go with a solid 3.
Wow. Okay, that sounds pretty good. It's funny when you're saying it's complicated. Like, there's lots of scripts involved.
Too many.
Traditionally, there just used to be one script for a movie. But anyway, I guess that's what happens when something takes 10 years to make. Okay, we better take a clip of The Accountant 2.
I'd like to have someone check in on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, get a dog.
Do you have a dog?
I'm getting a dog. I'm getting this dog.
No, you like the idea of a dog.
Anybody who has a dog likes the idea of getting a dog. It's why they got the dog in the first place.
Do you have a permanent residence?
No.
Anyone do care for your dog during long absences?
I do not.
Do you keep a regular schedule in terms of eating, sleeping?
I don't.
You're a cat person. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, you know something? If I had a cat, at least the cat would miss me.
Doubtful. Possible.
That is a clip there from The Accountant 2. And if you've just tuned in, Chris Wasser is reviewing this week's new cinema releases, and he gives 3 stars to The Accountant 2. Complicated, but entertaining. Now, a movie I have seen this week, which you have seen as well, which is also out on the 25th of April, is Netflix's new action thriller, I suppose you'd call it, Havoc, starring Tom Hardy. We also have Forest Whitaker in there, amongst other people. Chris, what's going on in Havoc?
What's going on is that we have another action film that's confusing me.
there's Tom a theme, Hardy, people. There's
it really is. It really is. We should do an entire special on confusing action films. But Tom Hardy is the star in this one. And he's a man on a mission, basically. In this, the film never really establishes what American city it is. Sometimes I thought it was Chicago. Sometimes I thought it was New York. Doesn't matter. Not really. He is, Tom Hardy, that is a homicide detective named Walker. And he's in a bad place. It's coming up to Christmas, and this dirty secret that he has at work is threatening to get out. He's got a very depressing home life, professionally and personally, just in a bit of a rut. Saying that, he's not the worst cop in town. He is a bit crooked, but there are worse cops than himself. But as well as that, he's also agreed to help a crooked politician, played by Forest Whitaker, his name is Lawrence Beaumont, to find his troublemaker son, because it seems as though the politician's son has got himself mixed up in this bad drug deal, which resulted in various different murders, but also the assassination of a very powerful gangster who has a very powerful mother. So what does this have to do with Walker? Not much, but he decides to investigate anyway because his life is on the line. So he's running about town in the days leading up to Christmas, trying to find these very violent, very powerful Asian gangsters. He's trying to, you know, stay out of the way of some sinister colleagues. We've got Timothy Oliphant, Vincent in there, and his boys. They all maybe did something bad in the weeks or years before this film is set. Just don't worry about what it is. Don't worry about their motives, because I kind of got the sense while watching this film that nobody really knows what's happening. I'm not alone in this.
Yeah.
That's the basic setup.
I had a similar feeling at times as well. Now, the action is very full on. It's John Wick type of action at times, I felt.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, there is. Look, I have some things to say about this film. But at the same time, I think Gareth Evans, who gave us The Raid, heavily involved in bringing Gangs of London to the screens, he knows his way around flashy, feverish, well-choreographed fight sequences. And there is one sequence in here, and also car chases and gunfights, but there's one fight sequence in here that takes place in a club that looks... It could be John. It could have been lifted straight out of a John Wick film. You'd never know. But it's very well put together, and it's very impressive, and you can feel every punch, you know, you can feel every sting and kick and stomp. That's the sort of thing that Gareth Evans is very good at.
Yeah.
Plotting, on the other hand, it's astonishing that he hasn't gotten any better at this. And it's astonishing as well that this thing took about 5 years to get to us. Because I think at one stage, Gareth Evans signed a first look deal with Netflix, got the scripts ready for Havoc in around 2020, and started filming in his native Wales in 2021. He also wrapped in 2021. So this thing has been sitting there for 4 years. And at some point along the way, because of scheduling conflicts, because of COVID, it took a long time to organize reshoots. And apparently reshoots were necessary for this thing. And there must have been some extensive reshoots, because that's a long time to wait to actually finish the film.
Yeah.
And I think it shows a little bit in terms of the storytelling. It's quite messy, a little bit all over the place. Sometimes has to use narration very poorly to actually explain to the viewer what's going on.
Yeah, the plot is chaotic and havoc, as the name might imply, all right. And there's a feeling of being lost at times. I did find, because I agree with you about what you're saying, but I did find the action sequence nearly got it by the seat of its pants. But what do you think?
Yeah, the hand-to-hand combat sequences are impressive. Less so the gunfights, where it's just like, let's slow everything down. I think if you were to remove the slow-mo from this film, you'd lose about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But the way that people are shot and losing limbs, and it's a bit, okay, look, we've seen this. We don't need to watch it a thousand more times. It's all very cartoonish. So that kind of annoyed me a little bit. What annoyed me most, actually, was Tom Hardy, because I've been watching him in Mobland,
yes,
on Paramount, and that show has an awful lot of problems. But Hardy's not one of them. And he is very good at playing these kinds of, you know, sweaty, shady characters who maybe possibly have a good heart. And I'm just like, they don't know how they've gotten themselves into these circumstances. I thought here, though, he's quite vacant and seemed as confused as I was. And he seemed kind of distracted and disinterested in the material. And I think sometimes that happens with Hardy, where if he's not fully invested in something, he can't really hide it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because I wasn't sure what was going on with him in this. And I know this is a common refrain about him, but I really couldn't hear what he was saying.
He mumbles.
Oh, but it was particular. Like, I know they've said that about everyone, from my good friend Robert De Niro to Dustin Hoffman and all sorts of people. But it really, in this, he was hard to hear at times. And I couldn't find his center point. I wasn't sure who exactly he was for most of this and what his motivations were. So I agree with you in the large part. So what would you say stars wise for Havoc?
Yeah, I think it's a terrible pity to have Tom Hardy at the center of your film only to lose him in that film. So I wasn't expecting that. Look, Gareth Evans, very good again for the third time at putting, you know, piecing action sequences together, but his storytelling really needs to improve. It has to be 2 stars.
Yeah, I suppose I'm going to go 2.5 for 2 reasons. I did enjoy the car chases as well, and the action kind of held my interest by the seat of the pants. I also enjoyed Timothy Oliphant. He's always good. And
yeah,
Forest Whitaker is always good to see on screen. So look, it's not amazing, but I'll give it 2.5 for Havoc, which is available to stream from this Friday, the 25th of April. Chris Wasser, more importantly than me, gives it 2 stars. And before that, he gave The Accountant 3 stars. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Up next, the best cameos of all.
Some things are just better together. Movies and popcorn, gaming and friends, Breezeline internet and mobile. Bundle and save with fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month, and you'll get a free mobile line for a year. It's a match made in savings. Visit Breezeline.com today.
What makes a leader? It's a tough question, but this we know for sure. True leaders lead by example. They take risks and plunge into life with determination. And for real leaders, there's a symbol of high adrenaline and high achievement, the Range Rover Sport. The Range Rover Sport redefines sporting luxury with a dramatic modern design that meets a distinctive sporting character. And a well-appointed cabin brings a sense of occasion to every drive. The active noise cancellation feature filters out unwanted sound, making the cabin a cocoon-like sanctuary. Optional PM2.5 filtration reduces odors, bacteria, and allergens, while CO2 management enhances the wellness of everyone on board. Plus, you can curate the mood of every journey with configurable cabin lighting, and bring a hint of refinement to every drive with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Build your Range Rover Sport at rangerover.com/us/sport. That's rangerover.com/us/sport.
Time. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. Now, there is lots of talk of cameos, particularly on this show, because I have been loving The Studio on Apple TV, where Seth Rogen plays a new head of studio in Hollywood, and the cameos are to beat the band, from Charlize Theron to Martin Scorsese. And there's also talk of cameos lately because Home Alone 2 is back in the news, because there's talk of removing Donald Trump's cameo from it. Make of that what you will, but it got us thinking about the great cameos on the big and indeed small screen. Delighted to be joined now by the editor of Geek Ireland, Olivia Fahey. Olivia, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So, like, when it comes to cameos, I don't know, you said to me off air you love them. I love them too. I think it's that movie stars and people like that seem to be not taking themselves too seriously or something like that. But you tell me.
Yeah, honestly, I feel the same way. And it's always great to see just a very random face pop up in something that you're just not expecting them to, or even at the time you may not have realized it's them, and then later find out that it was this like massive movie star hiding behind a mask or something like that. I just find those little nerdy tidbits just to be very entertaining. So for me, a lovely little cameo always, always makes my day.
Yes, well said. Well, listen, talking of a cameo you might have missed, let's take a quick listen to this.
Janine, I've been transferred. I'm moving away for a while.
Well, I'm not Janine.
Janine, I've been transferred. I'm moving away for a while.
I know. Bob told me.
Well, I wanted to tell you in person. And there's no reason we can't be civil with each other. It's not that long ago we were talking about getting married.
Yes, but you're already married to the force, weren't you?
We're actually supposed to call it the service now. Official vocab guidelines state that force is too aggressive.
See? It's only ever about the job. It's all you care about.
That's not true.
No, you're right. I do have that rubber plant.
It's a Japanese piece, Lily.
You just can't switch off, Nicholas. And until you find a person you care about more than your job, you never will.
That was Kate Blanchett. And if you were watching on screen, you may not have known, because she's covered in kind of a bodysuit when she's investigating or working over a body in Hot Fuzz. Tell me about that one, Olivia.
Yeah, so basically we've got Simon Pegg's character is coming to tell his partner that he's going to be moving to this small little town to work on their police department. And she's in the middle of a forensic examination of a scene. So she is completely decked out. And honestly, even with like the British accent, and you can tell now once you know it's her behind the eyes that it is her. But up until that point, you would never have known that that's who he was talking to. And apparently it was just a last minute thing that they just rang her to be like, oh, are you free to come down to the set and do this little scene? And she was like, yeah, sure. Sounds like fun. And that's how they got her, which I just think is the funniest thing. Just happened to ring up Kate Blanchett to be like, hello, Oscar winner. Would you like to be in this little bit part that no one's going to know it's you? Like, who can do that? It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, en route to your next choice, I should say I was watching that this morning just to get that clip. And I was just reminded of what a funny movie Hot Fuzz is. It really is hilarious. Your next one is bizarre because for a long time, nobody knew. We're talking about Glenn Close in Hook, as in the Robin Williams reinterpretation of Peter Pan, right?
Yeah, I watched this over Christmas every single year. And up until I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I had not heard that it was Glenn Close. So when this news reached my ears, I quite literally ran to try and like find the DVD, put it back into the thing and be like, I am seeing if this is actually Glenn Close. And sure enough, once you know, you could kind of still see it. But the hair and makeup department did such a great job of turning her into a male pirate who gets brought into the boo-boo box because they doubted that Captain Hook could defeat Peter Pan and kidnap his children. For those of you who don't know, that's literally the gist of the film.
Mm.
And basically, there's just this hilarious scene where like Glenn's pirate is just literally screaming to be like, no, don't put me into the boo-boo box. And he's thrown into this box with them, a bunch of scorpions. And so if you didn't know it was her, there you go. That's who played that pirate. It's Glenn Close.
And tell me this, you mentioned you watch Hook every year or used to watch it every year. I have not seen that in a very long time. Is it any good?
Oh, do you know what? I love it. And I do have to say, I think Dustin Hoffman as Captain Hook is the best cinematic adaptation of Captain Hook. He was superb. And even Bob Hoskins as Smee, the two of them just bounced off each other so brilliantly that, yeah, no, for me, it has a very special place in my heart. And even though people often question whether or not it's a Christmas film, it is technically set at Christmas. So okay. It does actually qualify as a Christmas film. It's a bit like that Die Hard kind of debate that goes on.
Well, we may have to add that to our Fardy Christmas viewing list because we're running out of good Christmas movies to watch. But anyway, let's not get into Christmas here with Easter only wetting the ground. I'm sure you know this, Olivia, but Daniel Craig had a very similar one in The Force Awakens. He plays a stormtrooper with a couple of lines, but he has his mask on the whole way through it. And Daisy Ridley does the force on him. And I'm not sure if that's the correct verb, to have the force done on you, but she makes him release her. And it was Daniel Craig. A lot of people didn't know that. Did you know that?
I did, actually. And I always remember I'm a massive Star Wars nerd, so it's literally my bread and butter. But
no apologies necessary on this show.
Yeah, I love that. And I remember even watching it being like, I know that voice. I know that voice. Where do I know that voice from? And it was like between Daniel Craig and I forget who, but I was like between two of them. So when I found out that it was Daniel Craig, I was just like, oh, I get to keep my geek card. I still have it.
Excellent. Now, if this was a normal show, I would just let you talk, but it's fronted by an egomaniac. So I want to play this choice for the best cameos of all time.
That's me, sir. It's good to finally meet you at last. Get some face time.
And who here is a key grip?
You. Hit that director in the face. Really fucking hard.
Oh, ow, ow, ow.
This is your fault. You limey shit the money bag, my friend.
That was a clip of Tom Cruise playing Les Grossman in Tropic Thunder, where he plays a studio executive. It's rumored to be based on all sorts of people, not least of all Harvey Weinstein is often mentioned. Suffice to say, he plays a hilarious creep, probably a lot more charming than Harvey Weinstein ever could claim to be. He is the quintessential Hollywood studio executive, as we imagine him to be, who just cares about the money, but throws in some brilliant dance moves. The reason why I love this one, Olivia, is that it's so incongruous to, you know, we know Tom Cruise, great actor, but can be quite controlling of his persona, let's say, in the public imagination. He lets it all hang out here, really, I think.
Oh, totally. It was such a departure from what we'd seen him do over the last, say, decade. And even then, I actually don't even think I could remember him doing a comedy to this extent. Like Jerry Maguire, yes, like that is a humorous performance to a certain extent, but he just goes for like balls to the wall. He just goes for it. And it was so, so surprising. I think also like the prosthetics and the fat suit and things like that really lent to that. When you look at him again, you wouldn't think that it's Tom Cruise at first glance. And that really helped him like kind of shed his perfect persona and just really lean into the role. And oh my God, was he brilliant in that. Between that and his kind of villainous turn in Collateral, I just thought those two performances are some of my favorites of his, actually.
Yeah, I suppose you could argue, is it technically a cameo? Because, well, it's only 6 minutes, according to the internet. So I guess it does qualify as a cameo. Tell me this. On your list, I notice you have Henry Cavill. Tell me what this one is, because I'm not vaguely aware of this.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so for Deadpool and Wolverine fans... He appeared in that montage where Deadpool is trying to find himself a new Wolverine for his universe to help save the universe.
Coming back to me now, yes.
And he sees this one Wolverine is tinkering with a motorcycle. And when he turns around with a cigar in mouth, it's Henry Cavill, who is now only the third person to play Wolverine on the big screen after, of course, Hugh Jackman and Troy Sivan, the singer, who actually played the young Wolverine in Wolverine Origins. So they, up until that point, they were the only two actors to have ever played the character, which I think is wild. This is, of course, excluding the animated series. So for Henry Cavill to show up and then for all the jokes to be made to be like, oh, we'll treat you so much better than those douches down the street. Like, they really lent into the whole thing of like, oh no, come to Marvel. Like, maybe you should really do this later on. Once Hugh hangs up the cowl, I think you should take this on. So yeah, I thought it was a great cameo appearance. And what I even loved more when I was at a junket preview screening, we get shown like a very short like snippet of footage before the junket. Sometimes you get the whole film, sometimes you just get about 20 minutes. And in this time, they'd actually edited that bit out so that when I went to see the whole film, I hadn't seen that section yet. So I was as surprised as everybody else in the room that Henry Cavill had just appeared on the screen. And I think for me, that's what made it even special, is that they made sure that everybody was surprised. And I just loved it.
Yeah, excellent. Now let's talk TV. The Last of Us, which is, people are rightly loving the second season, has started. But what's the cameo in the first season of The Last of Us?
So there's a lot of discussion as to whether or not the actors from video games, especially if they're doing performance capture as opposed to just motion capture or voice, whether or not they should actually be cast in the roles when they're being adapted for film and television. But I think what The Last of Us series has done was very clever in the fact that they actually had some of their lead actors from the video games appear as different characters, or in some cases the same characters, in the season. So in the first season, we had Troy Baker, who is a very famous video game star. He actually was in it as one of the cannibalistic groups. He was one of their leaders towards the latter episodes of season one. Ashley Johnson, who played Ellie, she was actually she played Ellie's mother in the series. So in that clip, when you see how Ellie actually became immune, sorry, spoiler alert for people who haven't watched season one, but if you haven't, what are you doing? Go watch season one. She get to see her and how Ellie became immune, and it's always a lovely way to say, it's like, oh well, here's the actress who actually originated the role and giving birth to the new one. So I thought that was a really lovely touch. The actress who played Marianne in the game and in the series are the same, and even in season two we have Jeffrey Wright is playing a character called Isaac, who he actually played in The Last of Us Part 2, which the second season is based on mostly. So it's always really nice when you get to see them do those little Easter eggs for the fans, not just the very obvious kind of gameplay sequence shot for shot remakes in it. You get to have like these little tidbits as well. Be like, oh my God, I know that voice. I know that actor. It is so-and-so from the game. So yeah, it's really, really lovely. They also had one of my favorites was seeing the character Perry on the screen. He's actually played by the actor who played Tommy in the game. And he played a completely different character in this as well. So that was, for me as like, you know, big nerd, those little tidbits I just really loved.
Yeah, it's a brave new world where video game actors are now playing their characters in the real life TV version of the video game. Go figure, but fascinating stuff. That's another item we should do in and of itself at some time. Talking of TV, I think, you know, that we don't have a huge amount of time to go into all the various TV cameos, but to my mind, Ricky Gervais and extras, they were the greatest series of TV cameos ever. And
Good.
High point, the watermark of all TV cameos is the late great David Bowie opposite Ricky Gervais, where he, you know, almost on the spot makes up a song about how bad Ricky Gervais's character's career was going. I mean, to me, that's the greatest cameo ever. And to get David Bowie into a TV show alone is just a remarkable feat.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people kind of forget that David Bowie was actually a very good actor. Like, he also had cameo in Zoolander as well, which a lot of people enjoyed. But he had a lead role in Pan's Labyrinth, which was excellent. So
Labyrinth, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Labyrinth, not Pan's Labyrinth, yes. No. Maybe I should hand back my geek card after that
No, we're all allowed a few of those. So listen, en route to your few last choices, I'm going to play my last favorite one.
A pleasure to meet you, Marcus.
Likewise, Keanu. I love your outfit.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Tom Ford made it custom for me.
I didn't know you wore glasses.
Oh, I don't. My eyes are perfect. This is for a part. They don't even have lenses in them. See?
Well.
I love the suit. Classic.
Thank you, thank you. It's my old tux from prom.
That's great. I dropped out of high school, went to work, followed my dream.
That is Keanu Reeves sending himself up to the hilt in Always Be My Maybe, the great Ali Wong rom-com, a great rom-com from a couple of years ago, now on Netflix, where Keanu Reeves went full Keanu. Olivia, to your eternal shame, I gather you haven't seen this.
No, and every time I see it come up on these lists when people ask me, it's like, oh, it's like gone down as like one of the best cameos of all time. I'm like, yes, I know. And I love Keanu Reeves with a passion. He is one of those actors who, like, if anything bad ever came out about him, I think the world would actually crumble. Yeah. But yes, it's on my watch list. But as you well know, those watch lists just get longer and longer and longer.
They're not getting any shorter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, tell me this. En route to telling me about Dan Aykroyd and Casper, tell me quickly about Matt Damon and Luke Hemsworth in Thor Ragnarok.
Thor Ragnarok, I have to say, I think is my favorite Marvel movie. And partially because of its massive tonal shift. And one of the best examples of that in the film is when Loki, who is appearing as Odin at the time, has this play going on about Loki's heroics in the previous film. And playing Loki as the actor is Matt Damon. And then playing Thor, you have Luke Hemsworth, aka Chris Hemsworth's brother. And there's even Sam Neill is playing Odin in it as well. And it's just, it comes from left field. Nobody had any idea it was coming. It is humor to the hilt. It's just brilliant.
It certainly is. And then finally, Dan Aykroyd in Casper. I had completely forgotten about this. Remind people.
Oh, okay. So you have Dibbs and Carrigan, played by Kathy Moriarty. They are trying to get rid of Casper and his uncles from the manor, and they are using everything. They're using priests, and suddenly they decide, you know, why don't we just get a Ghostbuster? And so you just literally see like a load of screams and wails, and Dan Aykroyd, dressed up in his full Ghostbusters gear, comes running out of the building, and he goes, "Who are you going to call? Somebody else."
Oh man, yes, I remember that vividly. I'm sure they got lots of requests to do that. So it was very strange and wonderful that it showed up in Casper, you know?
It did. And like Casper, again, when you look back at some of the technical feats that it managed so early in the 90s, it really actually does hold up. So if you do see it on the telly at any point, do chuck it on. It's still a very enjoyable watch.
There you go. And I'm also going to have to revisit Hook. That has been Olivia Fahey, editor of Geek Ireland, talk to me about some of the great and some little known cameos on movies and TV shows. Olivia, thanks a million. Up next, an intriguing new Irish folk horror movie called Freiwacha. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. Now, Freiwacha is a new Irish folk horror movie. You don't hear that often, which is releasing in cinemas this very Friday. In it, Claire Mullally plays a lady called Shu, and she is leaving her life in the city to work as a carer for Breed Nocton in a remote village somewhere in a nameless part of Ireland, let's say. And they form a strange and deep connection. Shu becomes consumed by Breed's paranoia, her obsession with old rituals and superstitions, finding herself and her life unravelling by the end. I should also mention Shu is leaving her partner, a Ukrainian woman in Dublin, who is also pregnant. So she's going from a very cosmopolitan lifestyle to a very different one, it has to be said. And it was written and directed by Aisling Clark, who previously gave us Dinan from a couple of years ago when we spoke to Peter Coonan about that 3 years ago in the Eyes of Lockdown. I'm delighted to say Aisling is in studio now. Hello, Aisling. How are you?
Hello, I'm grand.
So listen, first of all, the pronunciation. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I thought you did a very good job.
Excellent. We're off to a wonderful start. But my understanding is in English, that translates as roots. Yeah. Now, obviously, this is Irish language, but you're very keen to use Freiwacha as opposed to roots because it kind of conveys something different.
Yeah, I mean, the English word is just a bit weak and weedy, I think.
Mm.
Whereas the Irish word has this texture to it and it evokes, it has this kind of heft.
Mm.
So it evokes thick, heavy, tangled roots that are buried deep in the ground, and you have to get your shovel to break them up, and you can't plant anything. Mm. It comes with all that weight,
yeah,
which the English word doesn't have.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Plus, Roots was also the name of a serial from the 1980s about something very different, or maybe slightly related, but let's not get into that right now. There's a lot going on in the movie, Shu's character, but it's a very modern life she's living because she's, you know, I'm not sure if they're married, but she's certainly partnered with a Ukrainian lady who is pregnant. So that's quite, you know, of a modern lifestyle, I think it's fair to say. And yet she goes to this nameless part of Ireland that's very, it seems, backwards the wrong word, but very different to a modern cosmopolitan city. What were you trying to say there?
I think it's the film is kind of, it's like the new Ireland, the progressive, modern, contemporary face of Ireland. And then the place that she goes to, the rural Ireland, represents like the subconscious of that contemporary Ireland. Mm. You know, it's old Ireland meets new Ireland, and finds that new Ireland finds that it has a few lessons to learn from the old Ireland.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
There are a lot of traumas in both these characters' lives, and we don't have to go into them, but we get a sense early on that Shu, Claire's character, has trauma, and clearly Breed's does as well. And those begin as nameless traumas, but then become more apparent. But there is also this, and I don't want to give anything away, but there are old, they look like Wren boys. I know that's not what they are, but there are old Irish folk characters, and we see them at the start of a wedding, and they're wearing those kind of masks. Straw boys, exactly. Why are you invoking straw boys and things like that?
I think these elements of, we have these things in Ireland. It'd be very rare, I think, you'd come across a straw wedding now, but I hear that they do still happen.
Yeah. And it's fair to say we begin at a straw wedding, which I thought was a great way of starting the film.
Yeah. So a very traditional thing where these people who weren't invited to the wedding will show up wearing these masks.
Yeah.
And it's good luck, but they're also kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
That was the vibe. But we have these remnants of our ancient past in Ireland, thinking also of Puck Fair, where it's almost like we don't remember why we do these things.
Yes.
But we can't let go of them either.
Yeah.
They're still with us. And I think there's something really wonderful, but also slightly sinister about that.
So look, I want to get people to come to this, because aside from metaphors and dark history of Ireland, maybe, and issues around the way women were treated and all those kind of things, what I really like about this is a great horror. And Claire, at the start, thinks Breed is just lonely and isolated, but there's a lot more going on. And what I really love about the horror is a lot of it's in sunlight, which is very hard to do. Jordan Peele can do it, but it's easy to be creepy in the dark, right? So was that in your mind, I'm gonna shoot this brightly and we're going to get the jump scares in the bright? Some of them are in the dark, but some of them are in the cold light of day.
Well, when I was writing the script, I wasn't thinking about it like that necessarily.
Are you going to tell me it was just sunny when you were...
No. Then our shooting dates come in and I was like, look at this. This is the height of summer. And we were literally going to be shooting on the longest day of the year as well.
Wow.
So then we just decided to embrace it. And actually, I really love it now because I like it when things are unexpected, you know. As you say, it's easy to be scary in the dark, but there's something very uncanny about someone running down the street screaming in the bright, broad daylight.
I remember as a child in my grandmother's house seeing, it was full of religious iconography, and in particular I remember a luminous Mary, and I don't think I'd seen one since I'd seen your film, and also the Sacred Heart, and being kind of terrified by these at night. There's brilliant uses of those religious symbols in this movie, and sometimes they're terrifying, and in particular shining crosses and stuff like that. Were you keen to invoke the kind of paraphernalia of Catholicism?
Absolutely. I think it's really hard to get away from Catholicism if you're making an Irish horror film.
Yeah.
And I think Irish Catholicism is very folksy anyway.
Yeah.
They have their own little kind of twist on it. But Catholic tat was a big part of it for me, you know, like just stuff. And I have one of those glow-in-the-dark Marys, actually. That was my grandmother's.
Right.
And the Sacred Hearts and all that.
Yeah.
It's just the stuff that people build up, which to me, and of course, Shu is supposed to be getting rid of her mother's things.
Yes.
Her mother died, and she doesn't want to deal with this job of clearing out the flat. So it's just, on some level, it's about all the stuff that we collect.
Yeah.
It's people, I suppose, who historically were very poor and didn't have many things.
the house where Breege lives, and I should mention that Shu's character, she's gone as a home helper or carer to be there, and there were some scary visits from her supervisor. But the house is great because it seems very reminiscent of houses a lot of people would know, kind of sprawling and not very well kept, but very big. And it has a cellar. Now, this might sound like a boring question, but the cellar is used to great effect. Was the cellar in that house or was that shot somewhere else?
The cellar was in the house.
Wow.
But we built the corridor with the red door leading to the cellar.
Okay.
We built that door because the actual door, you couldn't do a long shot.
Yeah, there,
but
okay.
The cellar was there.
Okay, wow. So that's an actual Irish house somewhere.
Yes.
Up the, you don't want people to call in, but is it nearby? Is it? I'm just curious.
It's on the border.
Okay. Say no more. They'll be haunted. You're probably asked this a bit, but you know, there's two things that seem to be having a moment. One is Irish language movies. Your last movie, Dinan, on Colleen Kewan, Kneecap, all sorts of things, but also Irish horror. It seems to be having a moment as well. Is that the case? Or do people just make movies and it just so happens three of the big ones happen to be in Irish and two of them happen to be horrors?
I mean, for the population size that we have, we're definitely making a very big impact beyond our numbers,
you know,
in terms of film and horror. And I think the Irish have always told horror stories. So we've been telling horror stories for 1,000 years or more. Mm.
But not on screen.
No, not on screen. But I think it's in our nature. It's in our bones, so to speak, to lean into darkness.
Mm.
And it's just natural that once we didn't always have a healthy infrastructure for the film industry, but we do have now. And it's like it didn't take us 5 minutes almost to start making a real impact in the world and to start. It's no surprise to me that horror films are a big part of that.
Yeah.
And it is something people are... I was in the States a couple of weeks ago. Everyone I met was like, Irish horror films, you know, it's really a moment.
I gather you have been doing a lot of touring of this movie around the festival circuit. And just, you know, we meet a lot of people who are on the festival circuit. And maybe it's not for you to answer. Maybe it's the person who brought you in here today. But what's the benefit to you of going to all these festivals for you in the movie?
Well, I mean, I think... you want to build a relationship with your audience.
Mm.
People get something out of that, out of seeing the person behind the thing.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that if people want to come and see my film, that's what I make it for, you know. So I'm very happy to talk to people and to answer questions and all that. And I think it's kind of like being in a band or something, I suppose. You do all of the gigs and you connect with your audience.
Yeah, and you're probably very glad to be there because this is what you want to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, I want to get there.
So have you done a lot of Q&As all over the world?
I have. I've been everywhere. Yes.
How does this, because this is a very Irish story in some ways, but you know, on the run from your past and ghosts of the past is very universal. How's it playing in Texas and other places?
Well, you know, you never know when you make a film it's going to go out into the world. And it did feel so like specifically Irish, but there is a universal element to it. I mean, a lot of people share these experiences. I think Irish people are extremely good at cognitive dissonance, at sweeping things onto the rug, at not really taking things on. Actually, in the Irish for I'm sad is Tá Brónarum or, you know, Tá Farragairm, I'm angry, which is kind of like it's almost built into the language that the emotion is outside of you. It's not internal. So you can just kind of, if you hunker down and don't look at it, it'll go away. So that's the Irish way. But I think a lot of that resonates with a lot of other people too.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never thought of Tá Brónarum that way, that you're othering your sadness. Fascinating. Such fascinating insights are contained in this movie. Frey Wacha, pronunciation still okay?
It's grand. Yeah, maybe not a gold star.
How would you say it?
I would say Frey Wacha. Some people say Frey Wacha, depending on your dialect.
Frey Wacha is in cinemas from this very Friday, which is the 25th of April. It's a fascinating watch. It's creepy, troubling. I really enjoyed it. I've been talking to Aislinn Clark, its writer and director. Aislinn, the very best of luck with it.
Thanks, John.
Aislinn Clark there talking to me about Frey Wacha, which is on general release from this Friday, the 25th of April. a damn fine horror film, a folk horror film in the Irish language. I kind of forgot it was in the Irish language. Maybe that's because I'm Irish, but it's a really creepy watch. I enjoyed it immensely. That is it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.